This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Rise and Fall of Dodo by Neal Stephenson and Nicole Galland. Performed by Lorenz Bouvard, Shelley Atkinson, Laurel Merlington, Joe Barrett, Will Damron, Luke Daniels, Robert Fass, James Foster, Tavia Gilbert, Arthur Morey, David Stifel, Charlie Thurston, and Kate Udall. Part 1.
Diachronicle. Preamble, July 1851. My name is Melisande Stokes, and this is my story. I'm writing in July 1851, Common Era, or, let's face it, Anno Domini, in the guest chamber of a middle-class home in Kensington, London, England. But I'm not a native of this place or time. In fact, I am quite desperate to get out of here. But you already knew that. Because when I'm done writing this thing, which for reasons that will soon become clear, I'm calling Diachronicle, I am going to take it to the very discreet private offices of the Fugger Bank, Threadneedle Street, lock it up in a safe deposit box, and hand it over to the most powerful banker in London, who is going to seal it in a vault, not to be open for more than 160 years. The Fuggers, above all people in this world, understand the dangers of diachronic shear. They know that to open the box and read the documents sooner would be to trigger a catastrophe that would wipe London's financial district off the map and leave a smoking crater in its place. Actually, it would be much worse than a smoking crater. But a smoking crater is how history would describe it, once the surviving witnesses had been sent off to the madhouse. I'm writing with a steel-nibbed dip pen, model number 137B, from Hughes & Sons Limited of Birmingham. I requested the extra fine tip, partly to save money on paper, and partly so that I could jab my thumb with it and draw blood. The brown smear across the top of this page can be tested in any 21st century DNA lab. Compare the results to what is on file in my personnel record at Dodo HQ, and you will know that I am a woman of your era, writing in the middle of the 19th century. I intend to write everything that explains how I came to be here, no matter how far-fetched or hallucinatory it may sound. To quote Peter Gabriel, a singer-songwriter who will be born 99 years from now, this will be my testimony. I do attest that I am here against my will, having been sent here from September 8, 1850, and from the city of San Francisco, California, the day before California was granted statehood. I do attest that I belong in Boston, Massachusetts, in the first quarter of the 21st century. There and then, I am part of the Department of Diachronic Operations, a black budget arm of the United States government that has gone rather badly off the rails, due to internal treachery. In the time in which I write this, 1851, magic is waning. The research that Dodo paid me to perform indicates that magic will cease to exist at the end of this month, July 28th. When that happens, I will be trapped here in a post-magic world for the rest of my days. The only way anyone will ever know what became of me is through this deposition. While I have managed to land myself in comfortable, by 1851 standards, quarters, with access to pen, ink, leisure time, and privacy, it has been at the expense of freedom. My host would not consider allowing me out of the house alone for an evening constitutional, let alone to seek out witches who might help me. One comment before I begin. If anyone from Dodo ever hears this, for the love of God, please add corset makers to the list of abettors we need to recruit in any Victorian DTaps. Corsets are intended to be custom-made to conform to the actual shape of a lady's body, and it's uncomfortable to have to borrow one or buy one off the rack. Although servants and poorer women generally do that, but do not lace them tightly, as they must engage in manual labor. Being here entirely on charity, I prefer not to ask my hosts to extend credit for a custom-fit one. But wearing this one, borrowed from my hostess, is just awful. It makes a Renaissance bodice feel like a bikini. I'm not even kidding. Diachronicle, Day 33, Late August, Year Zero. In which I meet Tristan Lyons and immediately agree to get into more trouble than I could possibly realize at the time. I met Tristan Lyons in the hallway outside the faculty offices of the Department of Ancient and Classical Linguistics at Harvard University. I was a lecturer, which means that I was given the most unpopular teaching assignments with no opportunity for university-supported research and no real job security. On this particular afternoon, as I was walking down the hallway, I heard voices raised within the office of Dr. Roger Blevins, department chair. His door was slightly ajar. Usually it gaped open, so that anyone walking by might glance at his ego wall, upon which hung every degree, honor, and accolade he'd ever collected, honestly or otherwise. When not yawning thus, the door was tightly closed, advising, "Do not disturb," in 48-point, lucida black letter, to make sure we all understood how exclusive his company was. But here it was, uncharacteristically a quarter open. Intrigued, I glanced in. Just as a clean-cut man was making a decisive exit, looking back at Blevins with an expression somewhere between disgust and bemusement, his biceps smacked into my shoulder as he plowed into me with enough force to throw me off balance. I pivoted backward from the force and landed sprawled on the floor. He retreated instinctively, his backpack smacking into the door jamb with a hard thump. From within the office, Blevins's voice was hurling a stream of invective.
"Apologies,"
the man said at once, turning red. He was about my age. He slipped out into the hallway and began to reach toward me to help me up. The door swung farther open quite forcefully, right into my shin. I made a noise of pained protest, and the pompous voice from within the room went silent. Blevins, thick gray hair perfectly immobile, dressed as if he expected at any moment to be sworn in to give expert testimony, emerged from his office and peered down at me disapprovingly.
"What are you doing there?"
he asked, as if he caught me spying.
"My fault, I'm sorry, miss,"
said the young man, again holding his hand toward me. Blevins grabbed the edge of the door and began pulling it closed.
"Watch where you're going,"
he said to me.
"If you'd been in the middle of the hall, you'd have avoided a collision. Please collect yourself and move on."
He gave the young man a look I could not make out from where I was, then turned back into his office, closing the door hard behind him. After a second of stunned silence, the young man extended his hand closer to me and I took it, with a nod of thanks, to rise. We were standing quite close to each other.
"I am," he began again. "I am so very sorry."
"It's fine," I said. "If you've annoyed Roger Blevins, how bad can you be?" At that, he looked startled, as if he'd come from some place where speaking ill of the brass simply wasn't done. We kept staring at each other. It seemed a perfectly normal thing to do. He was nice to look at in a rotsy sort of way, and his expression implied he didn't mind looking at me either. Although I am not the sort the Rotsy boys ever took an interest in. Suddenly, he held out his hand.
"Tristan Lyons," he said.
"Melisande Stokes," I rejoined.
"You're in the Ancient and Classical Linguistics Department?"
"I am," I said. "I'm an exploited and downtrodden humanities lecturer." Once again, that startled, wary look.
"I'm treating you to coffee,"
he said. That was presumptuous, but I was so pleased with him for upsetting Blevins that it would have been churlish to turn him down. He wanted to take me to the Apostolic Cafe in Central Square, which was perhaps 10 minutes by foot down Mass Ave. It was that time of year in Boston when the summer feels definitely over, and the city's 70-odd colleges and universities are coming back to life. Streets were jammed with parental minivans from all over the Northeast, moving their kids into their apartments and dorm rooms. Sidewalks were clogged with discarded sofas and other dump-bound furniture. Add that to the city's baseline traffic. People, cars, bikes, the T. And it was all very loud and bustling. He used that as an excuse to cut my elbow in one hand, keeping me close to him as we walked. Presumptuous. As was the very idea that you could walk two abreast in such a crowded place. But he kept making a path through the crowd with expectant looks and crisp apologies. Definitely not from around here.
"Can you hear me clearly?"
he said almost directly into my ear, my being half a step ahead of him. I nodded.
"Let me tell you a couple of things while we're walking. By the time we get to the cafe, if you think I'm a creep or a nutcase, just tell me, and I'll simply buy you a coffee and be on my way. But if you don't think I'm a creep or a nutcase, then we're going to have a very serious conversation that could take hours. Do you have dinner plans?"
In the society I inhabit currently, such an approach would be considered so outrageous that, when I think on it, it is hard to believe I did not instantly excuse myself and walk away from him. On the contrary, at the time I found his awkward inappropriateness, his bluntness, rather compelling. And I confess, I was curious to hear what he had to say. "I might," I said. Confession, I did not.
"All right, listen,"
he began.
"I work for a shadowy government entity. You've never heard of it, and if you try to Google it, you won't find any reference to it, not even from conspiracy theory nuts."
Conspiracy theory nuts are the only ones who would use a term like shadowy government entity, I pointed out.
"That's why I use it,"
he retorted.
"I don't want anyone to take me seriously. It would get in the way of my efficiency if people were paying attention to me. Here's what we need. Tell me if you're interested. We have a bunch of very old documents, cuneiform in one case, and we need them translated, at least roughly, by the same person. You'll be paid very well. But I can't tell you where we got the documents, or how we got them, or why we're interested in them. And you cannot ever tell anyone about this. You can't even say to your friends, 'Oh yeah, I did some classified translating for the government.' Even if we publish your translation of it, you can't take ownership of it. If you learn something extraordinary from translating the material, you can't share it with the world. You're a cog in a piece of machinery, an anonymous cog. You'd have to agree to that before I say another word."
"That's why Blevins threw you out," I said.
"Yes, he's strongly committed to academic freedom."
Dear listener, give me credit for not going lol on... Give me credit for not mocking him.
"No, he isn't."
This startled Tristan, who looked at me like a puppy after you've stepped on his tail. On second thought, given his rotzy bearing, let's make that a mature German shepherd. He was pissed off that he'd never get any glory or royalties, I explained. But he knew he couldn't say that, so academic freedom or whatever. Tristan seemed to actually think about this as we crossed Temple Street. His type are trained to respect authority. Blevins was nothing if not authoritative. So this was a little test. Was his straight arrow brain going to explode? Through all the bustle, in the golden light of early autumn, I could see the entrance to the Central Square tea stop.
"What's your position?"
he asked me. "On academic freedom? Or getting paid?"
"You haven't kicked me to the curb yet,"
he said.
"So I guess we're talking about the latter."
"Depends on the paycheck." He named an amount that was twice my annual salary, with the caveat,
"Once you've convinced me you're the right person for the job."
"What will the translations be used for?"
"Classified."
I tried to think of reasons not to pursue this lucrative diversion. Could they somehow be justification for unethical actions or physical violence on the part of your shadowy government entity?
"Classified."
"And that's a yes, then," I said. "Or at least a possibly. You'd have just said no otherwise."
"That amount I just mentioned, it's for a 6-month contract, renewable by mutual agreement, benefits negotiable. Are we having coffee together or not?"
We were nearing the turn to the Apostola Cafe. "No harm in coffee," I said. Stalling for time, trying to wrap my head around the math. 4 times my current take-home pay, which would never include benefits. Not to mention that I'd be trading up in the supervisor department. We entered the cafe, a beautiful old, desanctified brick church with high vaulted ceilings, stained glass windows, and incongruously modern wood tables and chairs sprinkled across the marble floor. There was a state-of-the-art espresso station to one side, and, most disconcertingly, as much as I'd overcome my upbringing, a counter set just about where the altar would once have been, and a complete wet bar curving around the inner wall of the apse. The place had only recently opened, but was already very popular with the techno-geek crowd from both Harvard and MIT. It was my first time in. I felt a brief pang of envy that there weren't enough linguists in Cambridge to warrant a designated polyglot hangout as lovely as this. "What's your pleasure?" asked the barista, a young Asian-American woman with interesting piercings, tattoos in place of eyebrows, and a demeanor that blended, "I'm so interesting, and this job sucks," with, "I have a really cool secret life, and this job is an awesome front." Her name tag read, "Julie Lee, professional, which I understood roughly as, "smart-ass oboist." We ordered drinks, Tristan black coffee, myself, something I would never normally have, a complicated something latte something with lots of buzzwords I picked out at random from the menu over the bar, and which prompted a brief smirk from our barista. The agents of shadowy government entities, I reasoned, were likely to be trained in psychological evaluation of potential recruits, and I did not want him getting an accurate read on me until I decided whether or not I wished to pursue his offer. Also, he was rather handsome, which made me jittery a bit, so I decided to hide behind an affected eccentricity. The result being that he sat down with a lovely-smelling cup of dark roast, and I sat down with something almost undrinkable.
"You ordered that to try to throw me off the scent in case I was doing some sort of ninja psych eval of you,"
he said casually, as if just trying the idea on for size.
"Ironically, that tells me more about you than if you just ordered your usual."
I must have looked shocked, because he grinned with almost savage self-satisfaction. There was something disturbingly thrilling about being seen so thoroughly, so quickly, and so stealthily. I felt myself flush. "How?" I demanded. "How did you do that?" He leaned in toward me, large, strong hands clasped before him on the cafe table.
"Melisande Stokes. May I call you Mel?"
I nodded.
"Mel."
He cleared his throat in a very official-sounding, preparatory manner.
"If we're going to pursue this," he said, "there are 3 parts to it. First, before anything else, you have to sign the non-disclosure form. Then I need you to do some sample translations so we can get a sense of your work, and then we have to run a background check on you."
"How long will all that take?" I asked. 4 times my salary, with possible dental. And no Blevins. He had set his backpack on a chair beside him. Now he patted it.
"Non-disclosure form is right here. If you sign it now, I can text your name and social to DC.
He paused then and reconsidered.
"Never mind, they already know your social. Point is, they'll have finished the background check before you're done choking down whatever the hell it is you ordered. So, it's just how long it takes you to translate the test samples and have our guys look over your translations. But,"
he waved a warning finger at me,
"no fooling around here. Once you sign the form, you're committing to do this. Unless we reject you. You can't reject us. You're stuck with me for 6 months minimum as soon as you sign the form. Got it? No half-assedness on your part. So maybe we just talk tonight and then you take the form with you and give it to me tomorrow when you've had a chance to sleep on it."
"Where would I find you tomorrow?" I asked.
"Classified,"
he said.
"I'd find you."
"I don't like being stalked. I better sign it now," I said. He stared at me a moment. It wasn't quite like that first moment when we had stared and it had felt so strangely normal. This felt charged, but I wasn't exactly sure why. I would like to think I was simply delighted to be ridding myself of Blevins and quadrupling my income all in one go. But if I am honest with myself, I confess there was a definite pleasure in being chosen by someone with such agreeable features.
Right,
he said, after we had been staring for a couple of heartbeats.
Here.
He reached for his bag. I read the form, which said precisely what Tristan had described, making it at once boilerplate and singular. I held out my hand, and Tristan offered me a government-issue ballpoint pen. A far cry from the slightly blood-smeared Hughes and Sons Limited Model Number 137B Extra Fine, with which I'm writing this. As I signed the form, he leaned in closer to me and said quietly, sounding delighted with himself,
I have some of the cuneiform in my bag if you want to take a look at it.
I believe I gaped at that. You're carrying a cuneiform artifact around in your backpack? He shrugged.
If it could survive the fall of Ugarit.
There was a boyish gleam in his eye. He was showing off now.
Want to see it?
I nodded mutely. He opened his bag and drew out a lump of clay, roughly the size and shape of a Big Mac. So that's what had banged against the door jamb of Levins's office. Marked into it in tiny neat rows was cuneiform text. Tristan handled it as if it were a football. I stared at it for a moment, disoriented by seeing something I had only encountered while wearing gloves in the workroom of a museum, now casually sitting on the table next to my coffee-like beverage. I was almost afraid to touch it. That seemed disrespectful. But within moments I had tossed such a delicate thought aside, and my fingers were caressing it. I studied the script. This isn't Ugaritic, I said. It's Hittite. There are some Akkadian-style markings. He looked pleased.
Nice,
he said.
Can you read it?
Not offhand, I said patiently. Some people have a very romanticized notion of what it means to be a polyglot. But not wanting to appear lacking, I added quickly, the light in here is too low. It will be hard to make out the forms.
Soon enough,
he said, and pushed it back into his bag with the same casual roughness. Once it was out of sight, I began to wonder if I'd really seen it. Tristan reached back into the bag and pulled out something else now, a sheaf of papers. He pushed them across the table to me.
You still have the pen,
he said.
Want to get started on these?
I looked at the papers. There were 7 blocks of writing, almost none of them in the Roman alphabet, even the old Latin passage used Etruscan. At a glance, I also recognized Biblical Hebrew and Classical Greek. The Hebrew I knew best, so I looked more closely at this one, and blinked several times to make sure I was not imagining what I was seeing. I took a look at the Greek, and then the Latin to make sure. Then I looked up at Tristan. I already know what all of these say.
You've taken this test before?
He asked, surprised. No, I said tartly. I created it. At his confused look, I explained, I chose these specific samples and I wrote the translation key against which to check the students' work. I felt my cheeks grow hot. I did it as a project under Blevins when I was a graduate student.
He sold it to us,
Tristan said simply.
For a lot of money.
It was for a graduate seminar on syntax patterns, I said.
Mel, he said. He sold it to us. There was never a graduate seminar on syntax patterns. We, that is, people high up in my shadowy government entity, have been working with him for a long time. We have contracts with him.
I would happily sign that non-disclosure form 17 times over, I said, to express the depth of my sentiments toward Roger Blevins at this moment. Julie Lee, professional smart-ass oboist, swept by us, bussing our cups without asking, as Tristan's phone made a noise and he glanced down at the screen. He typed something into the phone and then pocketed it.
I just told them you passed with flying colors, he said. And they just told me you passed the background check.
Of course I passed the background check, I said. What do you take me for?
You're hired.
Thank you, I said, but whoever they are, please let them know I'm the creator of the test I just passed. He shook his head no.
Then we get into an IP inquiry with the university, and things get messy in public, and shadowy government entities can't go there. Sorry. If this project falls apart, though, feel free to take it up with Blevins.
His phone beeped again, and he checked the new incoming message.
Meanwhile, let's get to work.
He pocketed the phone and held out his hand for me to shake.
You have an agreeably uninteresting existence. Let's see if we can change that.
Diachronicle. Days 34 to 56. September, year zero. In which magic is brought to my attention. Tristan determined to begin the translations immediately, that very evening, and so he ordered carry-out Chinese, asked for my address, and said that he would show up in an hour with the first of several documents. I was, please know, outraged that he was driving around with ancient artifacts in the back seat of his beat-up Jeep. At that time, I dwelt alone in a one-bedroom walk-up flat in North Cambridge. Without being considered a spinster or loose woman, as would be the case in my current environment, it was walking distance from the Porter Square T-stop and an easy bicycle ride down Massachusetts Avenue, cutting through Harvard Yard to the department, although I would no longer be making that ride. Tristan appeared punctually with bags of Chinese and a six-pack of old tear sheet best bitter, which, as I was to learn, was the only beer he would consider drinking. He casually commandeered the living-slash-dining-slash-cooking area, placing the food on the counter, far from the coffee table, where he laid out four documents and the cuneiform tablet, a notepad, and several pens. He looked around the space, zeroed in on my personal reference library, pulled out four dictionaries, and set them on the table.
"Let's eat first," he said. "I'm starving."
For the first time, we made small talk. It was only brief, for he eats too fast, although I did not comment on it that first time. Tristan had studied physics at West Point, but ended up assigned to the military intelligence branch of the Army, which, in roundabout ways he constantly deflected with the term classified, led to his recruitment by his shadowy government entity. For my part, since nothing was classified, I divulged the source of my polyglot tendencies, that being, my agnostic parents having been raised Catholic and Jewish, my two sets of grandparents competed for my faith from my earliest years. At the age of 7, I proposed to my Catholic grandparents that I learn to read the New Testament in Latin, in lieu of attending Sunday school. Thinking I would never attain this, they agreed, and I was functionally fluent in classical Latin within 6 months. Emboldened by this, shortly before my 13th birthday, I similarly evaded being bat mitzvahed by testing out at college level for classical Hebrew. My Jewish grandparents offered to fund one semester of university education per each ancient language I mastered at college level. That was how I afforded my first 3 years of school. Tristan was very pleased with this story, almost as pleased with himself as with me, as if patting himself on the back for having chosen such a prodigy. When we finished our meal, he collected the disposable containers, rinsed them, and packed them neatly back in their bag.
"All right, let's start,"
he said, and we moved to the couch so I might examine the documents. In addition to the cuneiform tablet, there was something in Guanhua, Middle Mandarin, on rice paper, about 500 years old. Tristan, to his credit, at least knew to handle this with gloves on. There was also, on vellum, a piece written in a mixture of medieval French and Latin, I would say at least 800 years old. It was fucking... It was insane to see these things sitting casually on my coffee table. Finally, there was a fragment of a journal, this written in Russian, on paper that looked positively brand new in comparison, and was dated 1847. The librarian in me noticed that all of them had been marked with the same stamp, a somewhat ill-defined family crest, surrounded by blurry words in a blend of Latin and Italian. They had, in other words, been acquired by a library or a private collection, and been duly stamped and catalogued at some point. As he had warned, Tristan would not tell me where he had obtained these artifacts, nor why it was such a seemingly random collection. After several hours with them, however, I saw the common theme, although it was hard to believe what I was reading. In short, each of these documents referred to magic. Yes, magic. As casually as a court document refers to the law, or a doctor's report refers to medical tests. Not magician trick magic, but magic as we know it from myths and fairy tales. An inexplicable and supernatural force employed by witches. For they were, per these documents, all women. I don't mean the belief in magic or a mere weakness for magical thinking. I mean the writer of each document was discussing a situation in which magic was a fact of life. For example, the cuneiform tablet was a declaration laying down what a witch at the royal court of Keta was due in recompense for her services, and regulated the uses of magic that courtiers were allowed to ask of her. The Latin-French one was written by the abbess of Chalis regarding the struggles that one of her nuns faced, trying but failing to renounce her magic powers, and the abbess wondered if she herself was to blame, as she was not truly wholehearted in her prayers for the sister to be relieved of her powers, since those powers often made life easier at the abbey. The Guanhua took a little more work. I had but a cursory relationship to Asian language groups by then. It was itself a recipe from the provinces for a dish involving various hard-to-find aromatic herbs, as described to the writer, a circuit-riding Mandarin magistrate, by self-reported witches, whose activities were referred to as a footnote on the side of the recipe. Finally, the 19th-century Russian was written by a self-identified aging witch and lamented the fading powers of her sister witches and herself. This one also made a passing reference to the desirability of finding certain herbs. These were rough, almost off-the-cuff translations. When I had finished the fourth one, there was a silence between us for a moment. Then Tristan gave me a disarmingly sly grin and spoke.
"What if I told you we had more than 1,000 such documents, all eras from 6 continents?
All bearing this family crest?" I asked, pointing to the blurry stamp.
"That is the core of the collection. Others we collected on our own."
Well, that would challenge certain assumptions about the nature of reality that I did not even know I had.
"We want you to translate all of them and extract the common core of data,"
said Tristan. I looked at him. "I assume there's a military purpose?"
"Classified,"
he said. "If I have a context for translating, I can do a better job of it," I protested.
"My shadowy government entity has been collecting documents of this nature for many years."
"By what means?" I sputtered, both fascinated and dismayed to learn that a well-funded black ops organization was competing against academic researchers in such a manner. That sure explained a few things.
"The core of the collection, as you've been noticing, is from a private library in Italy."
"The WIMF."
"Beg pardon?"
"The weird Italian motherfucker," I said.
"Yeah, we acquired it some time ago."
His face twitched, and he broke eye contact.
"That's not true. I was just being polite. We stole it. Before other people could steal it. Long story. Anyway, it gave us plenty of leads that we could follow to acquire more in the same vein. By all means, fair and foul. We now feel we have a critical mass that, upon translation, might yield a sense of what precisely magic was, how it worked, and why there are no references to it anywhere after the mid-1800s.
"And you wish to have this information for some kind of military purpose?" I pressed.
"We wish to have one person do all the translations,"
Tristan said, firmly not answering my query.
"For 3 reasons. First, budget. Second, the fewer eyes, the safer. Third, and most important, if the same person processes all the material, there is a greater chance of gleaning subtle consistencies or patterns."
"And you are interested in those consistencies or patterns. Why exactly?"
"The current hypothesis,"
Tristan continued as before, that is, without actually answering me,
"is that perhaps there was a worldwide epidemic of a virus that affected only witches, and magic was literally killed off. I don't think that's it, but I need to know more before I offer an alternate hypothesis. I have my suspicions, though."
Which are classified, right?
Whether or not they are classified is classified.
The documents were many but brief. Most were fragmentary. Within 3 weeks, working alone at my coffee table, I had produced at least rough translations of the first batch of material. During that time, I also gave notice, apologized to my students for abandoning them before they'd even gotten to know me, moved out of my Harvard office, and managed to reassure my parents that I was still working, without telling them exactly what it was I was doing. Meanwhile, Tristan was in communication with me at least twice a day, usually appearing in person, occasionally calling and talking to me in the most oblique terms. Never did we email or text. He did not want anything said between us to be on record. There was something rather swashbuckling, if unsettling, about the need for such secrecy. I had no idea what he did with the rest of his time. Naturally, I asked. You can guess what his answer was. Our dynamic was singular, unprecedented in my life, certainly. It was as if we had always been working together, and yet there was an undercurrent of something else, a kind of charge that only comes at the beginning of things. Neither of us ever acted on it. And while I am the sort who rarely acts on such things, he is, while extremely disciplined and upright, the sort who immediately acts on such things. So I attributed the buzz to the excitement of a shared endeavor. The intellectual intimacy of it was far more satisfying than any date I'd ever been on. If Tristan had a lover, she wasn't getting the real goods. I was. At the end of the 3 weeks, when he came to my apartment to receive the last, or so I innocently thought, of my translations, Tristan glanced around until he saw my coat rack. He studied it a moment, then took my raincoat off of its peg. It was late September by this point, and the weather was starting to turn.
Come on, we're going to talk at the office, he said. I'll buy you dinner.
There's an office? I said. I assumed your shadowy government entity had you working out of your car.
It's near Central Square, Carlton Street, about 15 minutes walk from the Apostolic Cafe. How's Chinese sound?
Depends on the dialect.
Ha,
he said without smiling.
Linguist humor. Pretty lame, Stokes.
He held my coat out. I reached for it. He shook his head and glanced down at it, giving me to understand that he was not handing it to me, but offering to help me put it on. A gesture much more common in 1851 London than it was in that time and place. Some low-grade physical comedy ensued as I turned my back on him and tried to find the armholes with my hands. What a weirdo. Carlton Street was the poor stepchild in an extended family of alleys and byways near MIT, where scores of biotech companies fledged. Most of the neighborhood had been rebranded into slick office complexes with landscaped parks, mini-campuses, double helix-themed architectural flourishes, and abstract steel sculptures abounding. Tristan's building, however, had not yet been reclaimed. It was utterly without character. A block-long, two-story, mid-20th-century building, thrown together of tilt-up concrete slabs, painted a dingy gray, that somehow managed to clash with the sidewalk. There were a few graffiti tags. The windows were without adornment, all of them outfitted with vertical vinyl blinds, all dusty and askew. There was no roster of tenants, no signs or logos, no indication at all of what was within. Laden with bags of Chinese food and beer, we approached the glass entrance door at dusk. This building was one of the few places on Earth that not even twilight could improve upon. Tristan slapped his wallet against a black plate set into the wall, and the door lock clicked, releasing. Inside, we moved between buzzing fluorescent lights and matted industrial carpeting, down a corridor past several windowless doors, slabs of wood, dirty around the knobs, blazoned with signs bearing names of what I assumed were tech startups. Some of these had actual logos, some just cutesy names printed in block letters, and one was just a domain name scrawled on a sticky note. We walked the entire length of the building and came to a door next to a stairwell. Its only distinguishing feature was a crude magic marker drawing of a bird, seen in profile, drawn on the back of a Chinese menu, blue-taped to the wood. The bird was somewhat comical, with a prominent beak and big feet. Dodo? I guessed. Tristan made no answer. He was unlocking the door. I'll take that as a yes. You'd have jumped all over me if I'd guessed the wrong species. He gave me an inscrutable raised eyebrow look over his shoulder as he pushed the door open and reached for the light switch. You have a gift for caricature, I told him as I followed him in.
Dodo welcomes you, he said.
Department of something?
Of something classified.
The room was at most 10 feet by 15 feet. Two desks were shoved into opposite corners, each with a flat panel monitor and keyboard. The walls were lined with an assortment of used IKEA bookshelves that I suspected he'd pulled out of dumpsters a few weeks ago, and a couple of tall, skinny safes of the type used to store rifles and shotguns. Perched on top of these were military-looking souvenirs that I assumed dated from some earlier phase of Tristan's career. The shelves were filled with ancient books and artifacts I recognized very well. In the middle of the room was a long table. Beneath it was a bedroll, just a yoga mat wrapped around a pillow and secured with a bungee cord. I pointed at the bedroll. How long have you...
I shower at the gym, if that's your worry.
He pointed to the closer of the two desks by the door.
This one will be yours.
Oh, I said, not sure what else to say. Do you have guns in here?
Would that be a problem for you?
He inquired, setting the Chinese food on the table in the middle.
If so, I need to know sooner rather than later, because...
How much firepower were you expecting to need?
Oh, you noticed the gun safes?
He asked, tracking my gaze.
No.
He turned to one of them and punched a series of digits into the keypad on its front. It beeped, and he swung the door open to reveal that it was stuffed from top to bottom with documents.
I keep the most sensitive material in these.
My gaze had wandered to my desk. I was looking at the flat panel display, which was showing a few lines of green text on a black background, and a blinking cursor where it was apparently expecting me to type something in. Where did you get these computers? A garage sale from 1975?
They are running a secure operating system you've never heard of,
he explained.
It's called Shiny Hat.
Shiny Hat.
Yes, the most clinically paranoid operating system in the world. Since you have an overdeveloped sense of irony, Stokes, you might like to know that we acquired it from hackers who were specifically worried about being eavesdropped on by shadowy government entities. Now, they work for us.
Have they got the memo about the invention of the computer mouse? Because I don't see one on my desk.
Graphical user interfaces introduce security holes that can be exploited by black hat hackers. Shiny Hat is safe against that kind of malware, but the user interface is Spartan. I'll bring you up to speed.
His desk was crowded with copies of everything I had been translating for him over the past weeks. My notes were marked up with colored pencil notes of his own. He transferred some of those to the central table while I set up the Chinese food. He read over my day's work as we ate. Then we reviewed all the material to date. It took us until sunrise. In all the documents I deciphered, there was almost no useful information to be gleaned regarding the how of magic, which is what I assumed Tristan's bosses had been hoping for. We discovered some examples of magic, in that we learned what was valued by both the witches themselves and those who employed them. Of highest value was what Tristan called psyops, psychological operations, mind control essentially, and shape-shifting, themselves or others. This was considered a weapon of considerable significance, whether it meant turning oneself into a lion or turning an enemy into a lower form of life. In homage to Monty Python, we employed Newt as shorthand. Of middling value was the transubstantiation of materials and the animating of inanimate objects. Of low value was space-slash-time shifting, such as teleportation, which was viewed as a laborious leisure-time diversion across all witch populations. Much of what I had associated with magic in my bookish youth was disappointingly absent. There were few references to the mastering of natural forces, for instance, and there was absolutely nothing about the mechanics of making any of it happen. We did, however, glean something significant about magic's decline, and this is what led to our next stage of inquiry. Diachronicle. Days 57 to 221. Winter. Year 0. In which Tristan determines to fix magic. At dawn, Tristan drove me home to collect my library, which had been taking up a significant section of my living room since I'd moved out of my faculty office. He plied me with coffee and croissant until I felt able to start a new day without having completed the previous one. Back at the office, he smiled broadly and presented me with a combination to one of the gun safes. It was full of photocopies of manuscripts, documents, and artifacts I had not yet seen.
At the rate you've been working, this box will probably take you about a month.
I had no idea there was this much still to do, I said. He was pulling documents out of the safe, arranging them on the table.
Why would I hire you for a 6-month contract if I only had 1 month's work for you? There's a lot more where this came from. But it should be easier now that we've sketched out the general picture. You know what you're looking for now.
I still don't know why I'm looking for it, I said.
You know that's classified,
he said, almost paternal.
Have a seat. Want some more coffee? Working on a shoestring budget here, but I can spring for Dunkin' Donuts.
Dodo, I said. Department of Donuts?
Do you like sprinkles?
He asked. While he got donuts, I unpacked my dictionaries and lexica and got to work. If my translations were to be believed, at the start of the scientific revolution, Copernicus in the 1540s, etc., magic was a ubiquitous and powerful force in human affairs, and witches were both revered and feared members of most societies, every bit as much as military leaders or priest mystics. Although they were rarely written about, their work being so often the equivalent of classified. However, once the Renaissance gave way to the Enlightenment, magic became less omnipresent and less powerful, especially in institutions of learning and government. Judging by the hundreds of references in the texts, it paled increasingly through the Industrial Revolution, remaining most potent in artistic circles and least potent in philosophical ones. These two populations diverging after many generations of entwining, more potent in societies not blessed with booming industrialization, and slightly more potent, too, in Islamic cultures. And then it vanished altogether in the 19th century. The latest text was dated from July 1851. Dodo had not been able to find any references to magic after that, except as something that once was but is no more. I translated the box of photocopied documents in less time than Tristan had anticipated, but there was no let-up. I began to dream in dead languages, as ancient books, scrolls, and tablets kept coming, delivered to the drab office building almost every morning by unidentified couriers in unmarked vehicles. Department of Dusty Objects? There were plenty of documents in English or modern Western languages. Mostly these were transcripts of early anthropologists interviewing the elders of indigenous peoples. I translated the ones that Tristan couldn't read for himself, and he built a database.
Reader, if you don't know what a database is, rest assured that an explanation of the concept would in no way increase your enjoyment in reading this account. If you do know, you will thank me for sparing you the details.
A dreary enough task even with modern user interfaces. It was a mind-numbing death march when implemented on Shiny Hat. Tristan had to write little computer programs to automate some of the data entry tasks. One of the things we kept track of was the provenance of each document. Had it come from the Library of Congress? Was it simply downloaded from the Internet? Or was it a rare, perhaps unique original? Did it bear any stamps or markings from library collections? In that vein, a disproportionate number had that mysterious stamp on the title page, an image I'd come to know well. The coat of arms of some aristocratic family, with extra bits of decorative gingerbread all around it. Lacking any other information, I just entered this into the database with the code WIMPF. Quite a few of the WIMPF documents bore older stamps from no less than the Vatican Library, raising the question
of whether the wymph had stolen them? Or borrowed them and never brought them back? Tristan wasn't talking. Almost as fast as they could be translated, more books showed up. We would empty out a new crate and then fill it right up again with books that had already been translated, and the bland couriers would haul them away. To where? Many of the boxes were stenciled with a logo I did not recognize at the time, but which I now know to be a modernized, streamlined version of the brand used since time immemorial by the banking family known as the Fuggers. This phase ate up most of my 6-month contract, as a fierce New England winter yielded muddily to spring. Other tenants in the building, scruffy startup companies mostly, failed or got funded and moved out. Whenever they did, Tristan made a couple of phone calls and ended up with a key to the space they'd just vacated. In this way, Dodo's footprint in the building expanded. We inherited cheap plastic chairs, duffed-up coffee makers, and crumpled filing cabinets from the former neighbors. Clean-cut technicians showed up in unmarked cars and put card readers on all the doors, expanding and sealing what Tristan called the perimeter. The database grew like a dust bunny under the bed. Tristan thought of ways to query it, to search for patterns. We printed things out, stuck them to the walls, tore them down and did it again, stretched colored yarn between pushpins. We went down blind alleys, then backed out of them. We constructed huge Jenga towers of speculation, and then, almost gleefully, knocked them over. But there was never any doubt as to the gist. Some manner of cause and effect relationship existed between the rise of scientific knowledge and the decline of magic. The two could not comfortably coexist. To the extent that the database could be cajoled into spitting out actual numbers, it was clear that magic had declined gradually but steadily, starting in the middle of the 1600s. It was still holding its own in the opening decades of the 1800s, but plunged into a nosedive during the 1830s. From then through the 1840s, magic declined precipitously. As our store of documents, many written by witches themselves, grew to fill a phalanx of used filing cabinets and gun safes that Tristan scored on Craigslist, we were able to track the decline from year to year, and then from month to month. These poor women expressed shock at the dwindling of their powers, in some cases mentioning specific spells that had worked a few weeks ago, but no longer had effect. As it turns out, in 1851, the year in which I find myself as I scribble these words, all of the world's technologies were brought together for the great exhibition at the newly constructed magnificent Crystal Palace in Hyde Park, London. Tristan's hypothesis, therefore, held that this coming together, this conscious concentration of technological advancement, all in one point of space-time, had dampened magic to the point where it fizzled out for good. Like a doused fire, it had no power to rekindle itself once extinguished. The causal relationship between the two eluded us for a time. I suggested that magic's flourishing required people to believe in it, but Tristan dismissed this mentality as belonging more to children's literature than to reality. He was certain there was a mechanical or physical causality, that there was something about the technological worldview, or technology itself, that somehow jammed the frequencies magic used. We both began to read whatever we could about the great exhibition in the hopes that it might illuminate something. You may notice that I was exceeding by far my responsibilities as a translator. Translating, especially of obscure texts written in extinct tongues, often resembles the solving of a riddle. Here was a riddle to put all others to shame. Tristan's enthusiasm was infectious, and I could not divest myself from it. Having no other responsibilities, I became as preoccupied with his project as he was himself. Per Tristan's suggestions, I took out stacks of books from Widener Library. Harvard had not figured out yet that I'd quit. I suppose Blevins wanted to hide the fact, lest it reflect poorly on him. These included tomes on everything from heliography to Queen Victoria's private life, to Baruch Spinoza's sexual proclivities, to Frederick Bakewell, to the Tempest Prognosticator, to Strohall numbers. I would bring these to Tristan, and we would divide our time between perusing them and internet searches. We soon knew more about the Great Exhibition and its 13,000-odd exhibits than Prince Albert ever did. We knew more about its showcase, the Crystal Palace, than even Joseph Paxton, the gardener who designed the fucking... who designed the blessed thing. We learned little that was helpful. However, one evening in March, as I sat on the consignment store couch I'd insisted on bringing in to spruce up the place, and Tristan lolled on the rug, provenance ditto, beside a low table with a beer, each of us bleary-eyed from reading, I encountered a passage in an obscure booklet entitled Arresting and Alluring Astronomical Anecdotes, published in 1897. Here I learned that while the Great Exhibition of 1851 was in process, it lasted for several months, an event of relative interest occurred elsewhere in Europe, to be precise, in Königsberg, Prussia. For the first time in history, a solar eclipse was successfully photographed. I read the statement aloud. It set Tristan on fire with excitement. He had already suspected that photography in particular, of all technological developments, was the likeliest to have somehow impeded magic. Now, somehow, he was certain. It took me a while to calm him down to the point where he could explain himself.
I'll be honest with you. As a physicist, I am a hack, he admitted. I majored in it, yes, but I was never employed in that capacity. But if you cut me, I still bleed physicist blood. I'll go to my grave believing that if magic existed, there's a scientific explanation for it.
That sounds like a contradiction to me, I said, since our whole working hypothesis is that science broke it somehow. He held up a hand.
Work with me here. Have you ever heard of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics?
Only in cocktail party discourse that would make you roll your eyes and heave deep sighs.
Well, there are certain experiments where the results only make sense if the system that's being observed actually exists in more than one state until the moment when the scientist makes the observation.
Is this Schrödinger's cat? Because even I have heard of that.
That's a classic example. It's just a thought experiment, by the way. No one ever actually did it.
That's good. PETA would be all over them.
Do you know what it is?
Without waiting for me to answer, Tristan went on.
You put a cat in a sealed box. There's a device inside of the box that is capable of killing the cat by breaking open a vial of poison gas or something. That device is triggered by some random event generator, like a sample of some radioactive material that either decays, producing a bit of radiation, or doesn't. You close the lid. The cat and the poison gas and the radioactive sample become a sealed system. You cannot predict or know what has happened.
You don't know if the cat is alive or dead, I said.
It's not just that you don't. You can't. There is literally no way of knowing,
Tristan said.
Now, in a classical physics way of thinking, it's either one or the other. The cat is either alive or dead for real. You just don't happen to know which. But in a quantum physics way of thinking, the cat really is both alive and dead. It exists in two mutually incompatible states at the same time. Not until you open the lid and look inside does the wave function collapse.
Whoa, you had me until the very end, I protested. When did we start talking about, what did you call it, a wave function? And how does that, whatever it is, collapse?
My bad, he said. It's just physicist lingo for what I was saying. If you were to express the Schrödinger's cat experiment mathematically, you'd write down an equation that is called a wave function. That function has multiple terms that are superimposed. It's not just one thing.
Multiple terms, I repeated bleakly.
Yeah, a term here means a fragment of math. It is to an equation what a phrase is to a sentence.
So you're saying there is one term for cat is alive and another for cat is dead? Is that what you mean in this usage?
Yes, so linguist.
And when you say they are superimposed?
Mathematically, it just means that they are sort of added to each other to make a combined picture of the system.
Until it collapses or whatever. He nodded.
Multiple terms, superimposed, is a quantum thing. It is the essence of quantum mechanics. But there is this interesting fact, which is that
That kind of math only works. It only provides an accurate description of the system. Until you open the lid and look inside. At that point, you see a live cat or a dead cat, period. It has become a classical system.